Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This.
Drill, baby, drill. Drill, baby, drill. Was that McCain and Giuliani they were chanting for, or Obama? Now we begin an April Earth Month series with Andrew Revkin, who writes the blog .earth for the New York Times. As of today, in fact, .earth is moving from the news side of the Times website to the op-ed side. So we may be about to hear Andrew Revkin unbound. We'll see. Hi, Andy. Thanks for doing this series. Welcome back to WNYC.
It's good to be on with you.
And we'll start with the obvious big environmental story, the Obama plan for offshore oil drilling, and the announcement that they will no longer use the term cap and trade. And no, and I've said this about several stories already today, no, that is not an April Fool's joke. So a little bit first about you and .earth. Since you'll be joining us at this time every Thursday this month, what has this blog been and what will it be now that you get the license that the op-ed label brings?
Well, it's all an experiment. 2.5 years ago, after 24 or 5 years of conventional journalism, I dove into the webosphere and started a kind of an interrogatory kind of journalism where I'm exploring questions, the big one being how do we head toward roughly 9 billion people on a finite planet and not totally screw up? And it's just become this daily conversation about that where quite often readers are sending me in directions as much as my own tracking of the news.
And actually, your starting point is really interesting. Rather than how do we keep the planet from heating itself into oblivion or, you know, some organizing question like that, because if a lot of your writing revolves around the issue of population, I think people don't seem to talk about that much anymore, total world population. Why do you raise that as the central starting point?
Well, some of this, you could just look at the oil statistics and get an idea. We'll get to that in a few minutes. But, you know, the U.S. has 300 million people. We're heading toward 400 million, mostly through immigration in the next 40 years or so. We now use 20 million barrels of oil a day. China has over 1 billion people. They're only right now using, I just wrote this down this morning, 7 million barrels a day of oil for 1 billion people. India is not hardly on the list of big oil users, and they have over 1 billion, heading toward 2 billion people in the next 50 years. So if you think resource crunches are a problem now, you know they're going to be a big problem soon. And the whole question of peak oil or not is kind of almost irrelevant to that when you just have that much competition. And that's just oil. That doesn't count all the other issues we'll be grappling with.
Right. Peak oil being the theory that there isn't going to be that much oil even to extract from the earth.
Yeah, here you're just talking about perpetually rising demand. Even if we have more to keep pumping, you know, keeping up with that is a tough thing.
And then there are crazy stats out there when you look at the United States, like we have, what is it? It was on the Times editorial page today. 2% of the world's oil supply, and we consume 20% of the oil usage, something along those lines.
Yeah, basically. So we're super users of just about everything, and everyone else is kind of getting into gear to be in that, has that aspiration. So that's why, you know, I've never seen .earth as a climate blog or even an environment blog. It's a blog about our growing pains, essentially, as a species on this earth.
And I'm going to get that exact stat. Here it is. Let's see. A country that consumes one quarter of the world's oil but owns about 2% of the world's known reserves. And the conclusion here is, therefore, we cannot drill our way to self-sufficiency no matter what Obama announces.
Sure. And as I'm sure when this came up last year and during the campaign, the issue was clear that the Energy Information Agency and others who analyze trends say it wouldn't be reflected in our market price for gasoline in any perceptible way for a couple of decades. And even then, we're talking pennies compared to the other forces that are coming on the oil markets. It's really a minor thing.
So I'm also curious about the announcement by Energy Secretary Ken Salazar yesterday. This came on CNBC, and let's just play it.
I think the term cap and trade is not in the lexicon anymore. I think what people are doing is they're saying we need to move forward and we need to address energy independence. We need to create jobs for the people of America. And we need to deal with the dangers of pollution which are affecting our planet and our children and our grandchildren. And so it's in that context that the senators who have been working on this package will put forward proposed legislation that will try to address those issues.
So the way that's broken out on a lot of blogs ever since then is Energy Secretary announces that the Obama administration is abandoning the term cap and trade. Is that how you heard it?
Oh, yeah. Well, just look at the history of climate legislation generally. The first thing that went away was the word climate. In the old days, the McCain-Lieberman bill a few years ago, I think it was called the Climate Security Act, or I don't have it in front of me, so I can't remember exactly. And then around a year and a half ago, the word climate dropped out of the titles of these bills. It was the Energy Safety and Security Act or that kind of thing. So there's a problem here. And the problem is, as it's been with climate for literally the two decades I've been writing about this, it's still not the kind of issue that voters, when they go to a voting booth, have at the forefront of what they're thinking about. And that makes it very tough as a politician to make this a high priority. And that makes it tough, especially after a financial crisis, when traders and investors are not in high repute these days among the average population I hear from. So the idea of trading and who's going to get the money and cap, of course, connotes a restriction. And that's always a hard sell as well.
So and yet, like a lot of things in the Romney healthcare bill that became the Obama healthcare bill, cap and trade was kind of originally a Republican idea because it was seen as unleashing market forces, and it was seen as a success with respect to the pollutants that were causing acid rain, correct? We already have a cap and trade law with respect to that kind of pollution that's seen as a success, don't we?
Yeah, although again, here the issue is carbon dioxide, the main greenhouse gas, is just so fundamentally different than sulfur. The discrete set of pollutants coming from a power plant stack that you could deal with pretty economically. Right now, even a rough guess of capturing the carbon dioxide from a power plant and compressing it into a liquid or near and pumping it into the ground is at least a 30% of the energy you produce would be going to that process. That's basically, and that's a very rough guess. We don't even know where you'd put it. There's many questions about that. So it's a whole new category, a whole big scale question. The same thing happened with CFCs. The Montreal Protocol to protect the ozone layer in the 80s dealt with a very specific set of chemicals produced by less than 20 companies. And this CO2 is coming from a taxi cab in New Delhi, from a power plant in Boston, from certain deforestation in the Amazon. So how do you have a trading system for – how do you know that a ton saved in the Amazon is really a fungible ton?
So you're skeptical about the feasibility of cap and trade.
Yeah. You know, the way I've approached this issue all through my period this time looking at it is increasingly I look at it from the standpoint of the atmosphere. You know, you could have a political success. You could pass some bill, whether you call it cap and trade or whatever. But what I want to know is what would the atmosphere ever notice that? And this goes for the climate diplomacy.
Well, if there's a real cap, the atmosphere would notice it, wouldn't it?
If there's a real cap, meaning not with too many giveaways or what are called offsets that are softer, where a company could keep pumping, running its power plant, but buy acreage in the Amazon and keep it protected. How do you guarantee the permanence of that protection? How do you... There's all those issues, and those are the kinds of softeners that go into legislation as it gets closer to reality. In fact, when I interviewed Senator McCain back in 2005 for this Arctic documentary we did, he said, you know, basically democracies don't do very well with this kind of problem. The long time scale, the uncertainties, the diffuse nature of the pollutant, the problem itself. You know, and our politics is all about compromise. And again, the atmosphere isn't compromising. It's either going to react or not react.
Andrew Revkin, longtime environmental reporter for the New York Times, who now writes their .earth environment blog on nytimes.com, moving today from being on the news side of the website to the op-ed side of the website. And that may be a technicality. I don't know. Does it mean that you're going to express your opinion more? Does it mean that we're going to see some of your stuff pop up from time to time on the vaunted op-ed page next to Paul Krugman and David Brooks?
I don't know that yet. This is all, again, my whole career the last 10 years has been an experiment in a way. Even, you know, my work at the Times from when I went to the North Pole in 2003, I was testing things. So we did a live reader forum from the North Pole on the sea ice there, and it was all totally cobbled together. And the blog itself has been an experiment. There are aspects of it that are unbelievably exasperating. You know, trying to sustain a moderate, a constructive dialogue in the comment stream. And, you know, there's
We know about that challenge.
And many newspaper blogs don't moderate at all. It's just total spew. And that's tough. But I do see, you know, if I'm not doing it, I really don't feel I'm doing it being a complete journalist. So we'll see.
So back to cap and trade for a minute. Yeah. Does dropping the term mean they're dropping the policy? Is that clear to you?
Well, from what I've heard from what's going on with Kerry and his Senator Kerry and his partners on this, there will be elements where they'll be trading, but probably restricted to the utility sector, to power plants, which unfortunately eliminates a lot of the potential benefit, theoretical benefit of a cap and trade system. You want it to be broad so that as that ceiling comes down on emissions, you can reach far and wide to get the cheapest emissions reductions. So again, but it's in a real world sense, the power sector has already had, as you said, with sulfur pollutants, a system in place. There's probably a more realistic potential there. Now, there are many other elements to what may come out in the next couple of weeks from that team. So we'll see.
And I don't want to dwell on the politics here with you, more the science, but what we keep hearing is that President Obama announced the drilling policy in part to try to curry favor with people to show that, you know, he's not all the way on one side or the other, and then maybe people will be more amenable or even pressured by their constituents to support a comprehensive energy policy that includes some drilling but also some limits on carbon emissions. So we'll see. At the same time, they announced that they're dropping the phrase cap and trade. So it's all a mush now.
Well, you know, I think he's experimenting with something, and it's somewhat similar to what I've been trying to do on the blog, which is, you know, a lot of I'll explain why this is relevant. A lot of blogs serve a small, you know, if you're an environmentalist, you go to certain blogs and feel comfortable. If you're a libertarian, you go to other blogs and feel comfortable. And there's a polarization out there. And what I've been trying to do on Dot Earth is create a forum where people can kind of hash it out civilly. It doesn't always work. And Obama clearly, in a way, politically, is testing the idea in this incredibly polarized politics we now live in. Can you build from the center? And I'm not sure in the political realm it's viable, really.
But you've said, related to what you just said, you've written that as an environmental reporter, you don't go right to the Cato Institute for a reaction to global warming stories. But you also don't go right to the World Wildlife Fund. You go to scientists. What a concept. But here's a question that I have. How different are the scientists from the professional environmentalists?
Well, before we get to that question, the question always when you're writing a story on climate is, are you writing about the science or are you writing about the policy implications of the science? And you see, if I'm writing about, you know, how quickly we cut greenhouse gases, how much of a cost to put on emissions, the Cato Institute and World Wildlife Fund play a role in that story. If I'm writing about what do we really understand now about Greenland's ice sheet and how it's responding to warming, that's when I don't go to those.
But that story doesn't exist in a vacuum, right?
No,
scientists have Greenland's ice sheet, then you might understand what's going to happen to New York City in 50 years or, you know, the Maldives Islands.
Yeah, well, and what I do then, and because scientists are people and they are political and, you know, they have lives and aspirations and concerns, and that sometimes can flavor how they speak about their science. I haven't seen cases where the science itself ends up, you know, distorted in an overt way. We've seen a whole, you know, for months, allegations about the whole construct of global warming being some kind of fiction, which is just ridiculous. But when scientists speak to the press or speak to the public, they're apt to sometimes step beyond the data and express a view. And there, so when I'm trying to find out about sea ice or what's going to happen in the Amazon and when it warms, I do my own sort of peer review. I will send an email to 20 scientists and a group email. So they all have to kind of respond and with their peers. And it's a way for me to kind of keep track of the actual data and not just sort of what people think.
So maybe that's what we can do a version of on next week's show. And my guest, Andrew Revkin, who writes the Dot Earth blog for The Times, is going to be with us every Thursday during April Earth Month. Maybe we can ask how much uncertainty there is in global warming science? Because I always seem to hear it as an either or, yes or no question, and obviously it's more subtle than that. Or is there any other listener input you might want in advance of next week's show to move the civil scientific dialogue along?
Oh, sure. Well, you know, again, I listen to people all the time, and they are helpful. I guess a key question is for people seem to deal well with risk in their own lives. We all have, if you own a house, you have homeowners insurance, including fire insurance. Not knowing that your house is going to burn down, you do everything possible to not make it burn down. I would love to hear people weigh in on why they think we have such a problem as a species and as individuals with something like climate, which is more similar to me that it's more like Medicare or the national debt than like an old pollution problem.
So listeners, you can answer that question on our website at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show, and Andy Revkin will be back next Thursday at this time, and we'll talk about science.
It's great that this will be fun this month.